Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we're back, baby. Thanks for sticking with us during our hiatus. Even to the haters, bless them. We got a one-star review from somebody who was mad. They're like, great podcast, but we didn't put out enough free content for them, so they were mad. And gave
we had to take
star.
A little break, everyone.
I know. You know, people, we're just a bunch of hippies over here. We're trying to we're like trying to build an empire, right?
Yeah, and what would, and the first step is just how about a podcast that has any sort of income for us?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
This one does. It's pretty great, right?
We are on a mission to quadruple, everyone.
We're trying to build this thing, but the problem is we're like, you know, kind of a little bit like herding cats, except for both of us are cats and Bongo's the like herder. So we're working on it, just chugging towards oblivion. All right. So we have so many thank yous to do. So many new people to welcome and a wonderful tribute to longtime listener Donovan from Canada in the works, which will be, wait for it. The launch of our videotaped episodes. That's right. Pretty soon, you'll get to see how cute we are.
All we have to do is see if we can afford the cameras and figure out how to work them.
Hold on to your butts.
I'm so sorry to any brand new listener who's never listened to us before. Trust me, if you just fast forward past the second theme song, you will hear a true crime story.
That's what we all do, right? Yeah. But for now, I have a badass two-part series coming your way. You guys, Nick.
What?
I did some real-life clunky investigative journalism for this one. I am super proud of this story. I think it's wild, interesting, heartbreaking, all of it. I don't want to give too much away, though. So basically, I read something a little fluffy. I did some research and then might have found a connection to a much bigger, crazier story that sort of unfolds as a decades-long family saga told in newspaper clippings.
See, this is why you stick around for the inconsistent episodes, because when Muriel drops a gem, it is a treasure chest of gems. Are you hearing what she's talking about, people? This is going to be groundbreaking true crime podcast.
Stop it.
Into your earbuds and out your butthole.
That's not your thing, right? You're supposed to not like it. Okay. My main sources for this episode are archived articles from the Tri-City Herald, reporting from Kristen Kramer for the Tri-City Herald. Just a lot of, I'm not going to list all the individual articles. The docuseries Ministry of Evil, The Twisted Cult of Tony Alamo, directed by Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. The 1987 article by Lynn O'Shaughnessy for the LA Times titled Alamo Foundation Sparks Concern Again, Saugus Residents Wary of 60s Religious Group, and the September 2008 interview with former cult member Elisha Frankowitz by Sion Rue for the Oregonian titled Inside the Arkansas Compound, Tales of Abuse and Neglect. And then I also used a Reddit post on the subreddit Legal Advice. And if you can't tell by the sources, this episode does contain reference to some pretty significant child abuse. So just be aware of that.
We have too many shout outs to include at this very moment, but we do want to send love to the newest members of our Patreon. We got Sasha M, Rachel S, Harper J, DV, Stacy, Sarah M, Chris R, Amy S, Betsy DJ, and shout out to Eric W, Arnola King for increasing his monthly pledge.
Hey!
While Muriel and I took a little time off of these free weekly episodes, we kept the gas freaking accelerated with the exclusive stuff. We just released our 50th exclusive true crime episode and yet another non-true crime episode all about our recent hedonistic journey to New Orleans and my 40th birthday. Those episodes are unlocked as soon as you sign up for our Patreon or our Spotify exclusive feed. Check out murrealsmurders.com/support to learn all the details. We also want to thank Jay, Bob, and Heather, who each sent us a little cashola via Venmo as a thank you for the work we put into the show. If you guys have been listening to us for a while, you may have realized we bring in zero advertising dollars. Revenue, zero. So the dough we get from our listeners, aka directly people like you who are actually listening to us, that is everything to us. Thank you so much. If you want to see us shine, whether or not you can or want to send dollars our way, please tell your friends and loved ones about what we do. Spreading the word is deeply appreciated.
All right. If you're still there, man, this is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So many listeners are like Nick, and they don't want to hear about those kind of things. Go listen to a different podcast.
Plus, we'll probably do a little cursing and joking. So if you're sensitive to that, turn us off.
All right, Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay. Let's get started. So, I like stories in general, right? And I like stupid Reddit. Don't judge me. I do save links to interesting books or news articles, but I've actually never used a Reddit post for an episode. That's not really what we do on this podcast. If you're not familiar to all of us out there in the world who may not be, Reddit is a social media website for largely anonymous posts. There are terrible corners of Reddit, as with any internet-based or human-created thing. I go there mostly to read about people sharing hobbies, asking for advice, or post about some sort of juicy social drama that has nothing to do with me. And like I said, the posts are anonymous, so you never know, really, if people are making stories up for attention. Mm-hmm. So I treat it as like a fun soap opera thing / compulsive doom scrolling habit.
a terrible addiction of your phone.
Don't tell people that. I like a subreddit called the Best of Redditor Updates. It's so dramatic. It's for posts that unfold like a saga over time. So like, for instance, if I posted asking for advice in a dog subreddit about how to take care of this weird dog I found, and then a few days later, I posted an update that actually was a possum, and then maybe a year later, I posted an update talking about how I'd almost died after contracting rabies last year, right? Juicy! And then somebody, some enterprising person, would go collect all of my posts, put them in one place on Best of Redditor Updates subreddit.
Sure.
So that's how it works, right? So one day...
That example really makes it seem like you thought a dog was a possum and then got rabies. Just so you know, I don't know actually what you're talking about.
Well, it's
but that's what it sounds like. You just did a very specific weird hypothetical that 100% seems like your ass thought an ugly ass possum was a cute dog and then got rabies.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't happen, but it could. I almost touched a cockroach one time because I thought it was a June bug,
which was just on the ground at a nasty parking lot, and Muriel picked this up and screamed, and I was like, she's like, oh, it's a cockroach. I was like, who cares what it is? Don't pick it up. That's what you get. Anyways, we promise this is going to be a true crime episode any moment now.
So one day, I was rotting my brain on Best of Redditor Updates, and I found this nightmare of a post, right? Something, of course, that I want to get my nose in. It's one of those unbelievable hell no situations involving a spiraling situation with erratic neighbors. And that topic is really close to my heart, mostly because I think my dad was the erratic neighbor. And
a lot of people had to flee in the middle of the night.
Like, my childhood is full of things where I would like come home from school and my dad would just have this like totally self-satisfied look on his face, and he's been terrorizing neighbors one way or another. So that's his favorite thing. I'm not even gonna tell the stories, but It hits close to my heart.
Sure.
So this story was so over the top, right? That I or you would assume it was like a creative writing exercise by some weirdo, except it turns out there are actually a series of excellent articles by Kristen Kramer for the Tri-City Herald documenting the incident. So you still never know if the person behind the anonymous account on Reddit is actually who they say they are. But since I had the news articles, I thought it would be interesting to do an episode about this story. So I went poking around newspaper archives looking for details about the neighbors to kind of thaw out the information I had. And I found this incredible life laid out in birth, death, marriage, and divorce announcements. A marriage announcement led me to a documentary about an infamous cult that I'd never heard of. And from there, I found some old blog posts of cult survivors. And eventually, the trail of news articles led back to the Tri-Cities in Eastern Washington, where our story takes place.
Oh, damn. I've spent some pretty scandalous time in the Tri-Cities myself.
Did you?
Yeah, man.
When you were like a little kid playing baseball?
High school, yeah. Yeah, Franklin High School, go out to the Tri-Cities for some tournaments, and we would get into some things. I love the Tri-Cities.
I feel like you guys were very, like, sweet, though. We'll see. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
Medium. Okay, keep going.
Probably not that bad. I know you. I know the drugs you've done. I know it wasn't that big a deal. All right, so anyway. So the original Reddit post started in the legal advice subreddit, so pretty self-explanatory. People post about different scenarios in their lives looking for legal advice. Obviously, this isn't an awesome plan to get legal advice, right? But there are some self-described lawyers in the mix, and it's a really popular subreddit. So the post was titled, "Delusional Neighbor Bangs on the Shared Wall When Our Baby Cries and Nothing Can Be Done About It." Okay, so I'm going to paraphrase the post and then add in some information from the comments. But basically, here's the gist of the story. So first, the background. This lady, the one posting, I'll call her the original poster, her father-in-law had bought one half of a duplex back in 2003, sort of a condo situation. He does not own the whole building. He lived there for several years, sharing a wall with a reclusive older mother and her adult daughter who lived in the other unit. The women smoked inside, seemingly like chain smoking. And the smell of cigarettes was so strong coming through the wall that, you know, this father-in-law, his visitors would leave like reeking of smoke. Mm-hmm. So over the years, this father-in-law did a bunch of renovations, including redoing his side of the shared wall and sealing the crap out of it to keep out the smoke. Eventually, the father-in-law moved out and rented the unit out to different tenants. Okay, so fast forward to the fall of 2020. The original poster, her husband and their new baby are renting this apartment unit from, you know, the father/father-in-law. Mm-hmm. So over the decade and a half that the father-in-law owned this condo, he got to know the mother and daughter who lived next door. And while the daughter was caring for her elderly mom, the daughter did have some mental health issues. And recently she began to harass whoever was renting out the father-in-law's unit. So the father-in-law let his son and the original poster know, hey, listen, my last tenants actually left because of the harassment, right? This adult daughter next door was accusing them of child and animal abuse to the point she got so aggressive that they had to get an anti-harassment order. And when that didn't stop her from doing anything, these tenants actually moved out completely. And the original poster and her husband thought, it's fine, we can handle it. And they moved in and had zero problems until they had their first baby right in the middle of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And this is where the need for advice comes in. Every time the baby cried, the adult daughter would relentlessly attack their shared wall, screaming, banging on it, throwing heavy objects at it, like all the terrible things. And adding to this circus of madness, the original poster had two loud dogs who went off barking every time they heard the screaming and the banging. So it was newborn babies screaming, yeah. White hot rage banging against the wall, yeah, and then like end of days barking from the dogs multiple times a day,
right?
Every day.
Horrible.
Totally horrible.
Oh my God.
Speaking of barking dogs.
That must have happened. Versions of that, I mean, this sounds obviously incredibly extreme, but must have just happened to so many people during the pandemic. I remember when we were living above our neighbor, who we called our daughter, who's a very, hopefully now she's very famous, actress, influencer, queen type of girl. And and we wanted to throw things at our shared wall, which would have been our floor, and scream at the top of our lungs. We didn't, because we're normal people. We just sent very aggressive, mean texts.
We weren't mean. I was just like, we were like, can you be quiet? And she's like, I can hear you too. And I was like, really? Are you waking us up at fucking 5 o'clock morning?
You can hear us at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's not what we're talking about.
No, definitely not. We're talking about all the weird stuff you're doing between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m.
Yeah.
Christ's sake. I'm old.
Okay. Anyways, I I'm sure lots of people were in similar situations, although definitely not so extreme. That's really scary.
Right. And during this time, if anyone remembers, in 2020, there were wildfires raging in Washington at the time. And
all up and down the West Coast.
Yeah. And the air quality was so bad that the original poster couldn't really let her dogs out of the house to like just be outside while all this was going on. And she couldn't bring her baby outside just to get away from the noise. So they were just trapped in this box, right? The harder the dogs barked, the louder the baby cried, and the more unhinged the wall banging became. The original poster had called a non-emergency helpline a few times, but it didn't really help. The officer she spoke with told her, you know, you can get an anti-harassment order, but, you know, he knew for a fact it didn't stop this neighbor from harassing the last tenant. Mm-hmm. And he told the original poster basically her only real option was to move. The original poster couldn't afford to move. It was the pandemic. They had a newborn baby who was born in the NICU. So it was like a preemie baby, right? But she was really at the end of her rope and posted on legal advice to see if anyone had any ideas on how to solve the problem.
Yeah.
And this post got like no traction. I think got like, I don't know, three little upvotes. And then the only response was a comment that read, quote, because she owns the other half, not much can be done. So great.
So thanks for wasting valuable
internet
internet ink, lady, dumbass.
All right. So here comes the part that I like.
Okay.
Right. When it turns out the thing's on a possum and it gives you rabies.
Okay.
So then a year later, in 2021, the original poster updated her post. She wrote, my first post never got much attention, but the outcome was pretty wild. Basically, after her first post, everything just got way, way worse. So it was the same cycle of behavior, right, with the barking and
the banging
and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But everything just got more intense and more frequent. And then 2 months after the original post, the neighbor bought a megaphone to scream at them through the shared wall.
This sounds like an Ari Aster film or something.
Yeah, right. What is that? That's a Beau is Afraid.
Yeah, Beau is Afraid, and all this just like you're trapped in a house and just and it just gets worse and worse and worse.
It's the most terrible thing you hear, and then you hear that like weird squeaking sound when somebody turns on a megaphone.
Yeah, and then she's
like, you are, get away from the wall. Like just intelligible screaming, right?
Oh my God.
Unintelligible screaming. And she's screaming about how, you know, they were child predators and how she was going to tear them apart limb by limb. And the megaphone screaming would just go off and continue until about 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. So it was just way beyond the pale, right? The couple called police a bunch of times, but there was nothing to be done. One officer illustrated that by coming to her house and telling the original poster, I'm going to kill you. See? it doesn't mean anything if I don't actually do it. Which, come on, man.
Did you learn that at the police academy? Yes. They're like, threats 101 and why they don't matter.
The neighbor continued with the megaphone and also added in, like, writing a couple threatening letters, calling them child rapists, like all these crazy things, right? The couple put up cameras around the apartment unit and discovered that almost every night around 2 a.m., their neighbor would walk around the outside of the duplex holding her cat and stand staring into their infant son's bedroom.
That's just so creepy.
Watching him, right? Eventually, the next door neighbor, who happened to be, just by the way, a very like young, like youthful looking, very pretty, petite woman in her early 40s with like cute, short, curly hair. She managed to bust a face-size hole in the shared wall to scream at them directly, alternating with silently staring at them.
You mean literally a hole in the wall?
Yes. She
like cut Roger it. Rabbit style?
Yeah, or The Shining. Yeah. So she ended up cutting a hole through the sheetrock, through all that ceiling, right?
So now they just have a window into each other's units.
Which she, if she's not screaming, she literally presses her face against the wall and watches them walk around the apartment, right?
They didn't try to board that up.
So the smell when she busted the wall out also was unbelievably bad.
That's
like
scary.
Disturbingly
too.
Bad.
Yeah. Disturbing is the right word. Smells like that are so disturbing.
When the neighbor wasn't using the hole to scream at the original poster and her baby or watch the couple walk around their house, she would stuff the hole with newspaper. So the couple decided to like move a bunch of furniture in front of the hole to block it and try to just like not have that be something that's in their lives. And then they would sit there and they would hear her rustling the newspaper, taking it in and out, trying to get a peek at them. So it would be like quiet and then they could hear the newspaper in the room.
That's just so funny. If like a peeping Tom or something who's just not sneaky at all.
Yeah, right. It's just like, oh God. I mean, I think it's a little telltale heart too. You're just like, oh my God. Ugh. The couple really, they called police multiple times and requested welfare checks on their neighbors because this elderly mom, no one had seen her. Mm-hmm. She's living in the apartment. Nobody had seen her in months. But police said there really wasn't much they could do without a warrant. They couldn't get inside. And that, quote, if she hasn't been seen in that long, she probably moved. After 2 days of living with the hole, the original poster and her family finally moved out. And then a few days later, in early February, police were finally able to access the neighbor's unit and found the elderly mother's body dressed up in nice church clothes, decomposing in a deadbolted bedroom. Oof. The original poster said the daughter was then taken to a psychiatric facility.
Rough.
So the neighbors were 67-year-old Claudia Kinney, the mother, and her daughter.
That's not that elderly.
I know.
67?
I know, but people say
people
it.
People are kicking ass at 67.
Everybody says that's elderly. I was like, that's so.
They like, she must have just been like a really heavy smoker, so she seemed old. And
she had a
like,
lot of health problems.
Right, yeah. So you think, oh, that's elderly, but 67 is not elderly.
I know, we just turned 40. We're not even halfway through yet, right?
Yeah.
We have like another 40 good years,
I
right,
know,
guys?
We're Gen Z. You know what I mean? The living embodiment.
So they were 67-year-old Claudia Kinney and her daughter, 45-year-old Angela Greiner. According to reporting from Kristen Kramer, I think kind of surprisingly to me, Claudia Kinney's family had lived in the Tri-City area for over 70 years. They were kind of like this big legacy family in Eastern Washington. I found Claudia's father's obituary from 2000 and Claudia's mother, Catherine's obituary from 2008, both in the Tri-City Herald. And the two articles paint this like classic American family. Both Harry and Catherine were born around 1918 in Idaho. They met around the age of 20. They were engaged a month after meeting and married for over 60 years. early on, Harry worked for the Mountain States Telephone Company. This is kind of interesting to me. So he and Catherine lived and worked alongside a roving group of about 350 people who worked for the telephone company, who went town to town installing telephone lines in tiny towns in Iowa. So it was the workers and their families all kind of migrating around Idaho, installing these phone lines.
350, that's not a small group of people.
It's really interesting. And they said it was really fun. They'd have parties all the time.
I can imagine that being really fun.
Yeah.
Because that's like a big number.
Yeah. The couple later moved to the Tri-City area in eastern Washington, where in 1950, Harry was recruited by the federal government to open a variety store and sort of launch the birth of downtown Richland with this new store.
Governments used to do that?
Yeah, I guess they recruited him to open a McKay's department store or something like that.
Oh, that'd be so dope. So I was like, hey, Nick, you're kind of cool. Why don't you open a record shop on this street? This city's going to be booming in like 5 years.
Right. It would be cool, except for then you would realize it's just farmland. There's nothing there. So you'd be this guy with a record shop and nothing else.
Just trying to push like say she to the
masses, to the one guy who's like, I don't know. So with this move, Harry earned the title of Richland's first businessman, which they called him in his obituary. Harry went on to become a longtime commissioner of the Port of Benton, which is like Benton County was the county that Richland was in, and co-owner and partner in Spencer Kinney, a 50-year-old real estate and insurance business. So he was this town guy everybody knew. Every morning, Harry was known for having a 10 a.m. coffee break at Spudnut Shop in the Uptown Shopping Center. And then Kinney and his partner Spencer, right, used to roll dice in the coffee shop to determine who would pay for the coffee. They were just like characters.
I love that. That's awesome.
And for her part, Catherine Kinney was this beloved housewife, a super prolific community volunteer, and also a longtime church deacon. Catherine and Harry's first child, Harry Jean, drowned in a creek at the age of 2 while the family was on a picnic in Mountain Home, Idaho. So while they were a part of this early part in their life, their first child passed away.
Horrible.
They then went on to have 3 more children, all girls. So Susan, the oldest, Kathleen, the middle child, and then Claudia Kinney, the baby. Mm-hmm. Their life in newspaper clippings is like pure Americana, a hardworking middle class family. Dad is well regarded enough to have his political endorsements recorded in the local paper. Catherine Kinney is mentioned modeling historic hats for like a Rotary Club presentation on women in history. There were notices in the paper for the couple's golden anniversary. And the Kinney girls are all mentioned in little Who's Who articles in small Washington towns. So they did a lot of articles about Mr. and Mrs. Campbell went to go see their friends in Kennewick, Washington this weekend. They boated and had a lovely time. And it's just like lists of people visiting each other. That's why newspaper archives are so fun, because people really used to record. I mean, it was, I guess like social media.
Yeah, it's
now.
Like Instagram. Yeah.
But it's public and it's in the paper and there's like prestige to get into it,
Early influencers.
Yeah. So the girls are mentioned in all these little articles in these small Washington towns, singing carols and retirement homes and attending events with friends and whatever their to-do thing is, right? And the girls are listed also on the high school honor rolls. They used to print everybody's name who was in the high school honor roll on the paper. And then, of course, came the girls' wedding announcements. So first was Susan, the eldest, in 1966. The announcement ran about a column and a half in length, so pretty long, with this large black and white photograph. So handsome strapping groom in a white tuxedo, and then Susan, who's blonde with that like 60s style shiny flip bob and this huge poofy white dress. And then next came Kathleen's wedding, the middle child, in 1970. And this is more flavored like the 70s. A handsome brunette woman with pencil thin eyebrows and this subdued white jersey knit dress. Kathleen's wedding announcement shows her standing next to this mature young man in a black suit with this thick 70s mustache. And their wedding was also mentioned in the Seen and Heard column of the Tri-City Herald, spelled S-C-E-N-E and Heard. And it was shared in the column that she borrowed her sister Susan's blue garter for the ceremony. And the column and a half long announcement describes Kathleen's dress in painstaking detail and then mentions the reception was held at the River Shore Motor Inn, right? Very detailed. And then the very last to marry was the baby, Claudia Kinney, in 1974 to Mark Anthony Greiner. Reading this wedding announcement sort of unlocked this story for me. It was short. Mm-hmm. There were no pictures of the bride and groom. And it was sort of a random tacked on notice in the Tri-City Herald. Like, not a part of the wedding announcement sections like her sister's section.
This was not seen and heard. This was off to the side and hopefully forgotten.
Kind of, uh-huh. Right? Claudia wasn't married in the Tri-Cities in Richland like her sisters. Instead, she was married in Southern California at the Christian Foundation Church in the town of Saugus. The article doesn't mention what Claudia was wearing. Instead, it just describes the couple as missionaries of the gospel of Jesus Christ at the foundation. Claudia's parents and sisters both attended, but while the sisters were all each other's bridesmaids in the previous weddings, including Claudia, mm-hmm. Susan and Kathleen were both just guests at Claudia's wedding, and the officiants for the wedding were listed as Tony and Susan Alamo. So I started digging around for information about the church, like reading other articles from the 1970s. It was one of those hippie Jesus freak churches from back in the day. They had come up from Los Angeles to avoid being hassled by the cops. But, you know, I kept on reading headlines like vandals attack hippie church and hippie church harassment. And I was like, oh, no, you know, leave these gentle, long haired people alone.
Uh-huh.
And then I read a headline from the Newhall, California paper, The Signal. And the headline was Family Dispute at Services, with the byline reading, a disturbance broke out Monday night at Christian Foundation Church in Saugus when a mother of a married 15-year-old girl attempted to persuade her daughter from the church.
Mm.
The girl told...
It's a cult. It's a cult.
The girl told deputies she intended to remain at the church with her four-month-old baby.
Mm.
And I was like, is this a cult? Right? And the answer is yes, yes. It was a terrible, terrible cult.
Okay. So, and this is the part that you feel like you sort of uncovered that was not on Reddit or a part of any of this, the grid reporting, is that the lady that's dead in this smoke-filled crazy den is from this cult.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was because it was the first one that mentioned the people who officiated the wedding by name.
Yeah.
I was like, that's so odd. It's a like a wife and husband duo.
Yeah.
And they made sure to credit them with the thing. And I was like, yeah, that's really interesting. So
your spidey senses went off. And as much as I hate to give you credit for this, I don't know why I hate to give you credit, because usually sometimes it just comes back to bite me in the ass. Your spidey senses are very good. You have annoyingly good spidey senses. It's really irritating.
I have a taste for disaster. I mean, I have usually tell. I can always tell when things are going south.
You're like, no description of the dress, but they're naming the officiants by first and last name? Let me look into that.
I wish I had a nose for that. I wish I had it for success. All right. The Alamo Christian Foundation was an infamous cult headed up by psychopathic televangelists Susan and Tony Alamo. Not their real names. AKA the couple who officiated Claudia Kinney's wedding.
Uh-huh.
So, as far as my mediocre research skills could muster, there is no public record that I could find of Claudia Kinney, her husband, Mark Greiner, or their two daughters, Angela, the megaphone-wielding neighbor from a Reddit post, and her sister, Melody, until about 1989. I couldn't find any birth announcements, any honor roll announcements.
That's because they're in a cult off the grid.
I'm just saying I couldn't find anything. But I can't say for sure this is what happened. I'm just saying I can't find it, right? But based on the ages listed in marriage announcements and other articles, it looks like Claudia gave birth to two girls, Angela around 1975 and then Melody around 1977. And she gave both girls Faith as a middle name. Mm-hmm. Which makes me feel like she was still in the cult. All right. So in 1980...
I like how you try to be super impartial. Just like, I'm just piecing it together. But let me go ahead and slide in this quick little shade judgment. Back to being an investigative journalist.
So the next time we hear about Claudia Kinney is in 1989. According to the Tri-City Herald, Claudia surfaced again for the first time since her wedding announcement in 1974... when she came to her parents' golden anniversary party in the Tri-Cities alone without her husband or her children. I found one single mention of Angela Greiner, the megaphone-wielding neighbor from our Reddit post, before 1989. So I found one single post about her. There is a blog post from 2005 on the site TonyAlamoNews.com, which is basically a website where lots of people who were involved in the cult came to share information. It's a big hub that's ran by the people who were affected by Tony Alamo.
I know that you did all the work, and I'm just hearing about this for the first time. And you watched a documentary, so you probably know. It's definitely not pronounced Alamo, right?
Yeah, it's Alamo. I know, but I'm like, that's it. He chose that name. That's not his original name. They changed their name to that and then just pronounced it Alamo, which I find hysterical. It's spelled exactly Alamo.
Okay.
So this blog post is titled from 2005. It's titled Rebecca Remembers the Abuse by Tony Alamo.
Oh no.
By Rebecca Gay.
No.
And in this blog, she remembers being beaten with a paddle in Tony Alamo's Arkansas mansion in 1986 and 1987 with other children of the cult, including a girl named Angela Greiner. Mm. Now, I know this isn't official or anything, and it's some random person's decades-old memory. It could be a coincidence with the names. It could be fake, right? So I went and I checked out the documentary series Ministry of Evil, The Twisted Cult of Tony Alamo, and I'll be damned if our blog poster, Rebecca Gay, isn't one of the main sources on this documentary with a very long history of speaking out against the cult and also testifying against Tony Alamo.
Sure. So a very credible person, not just a random blog post.
Yeah. Right. So Rebecca also is roughly the same age as Angela Greiner. Mm-hmm. Both were born around 1975. And the documentary, Rebecca Gay claims that she was one of the first crop of babies to be born into the cult, right? A group of 24 babies who were then, as children, young children, shuttled from California to the Alamo compound in Arkansas in the late 1970s. So in a lot of ways, if Rebecca's blog post about Angela Greiner is correct and accurate, and that is the Angela Greiner we're talking about, we can learn a lot about Angela's childhood through learning more about Rebecca's childhood.
Right, totally, because she would be the part of that 24.
Yeah. Tony and Susan Alamo were both grifters in Hollywood before they were married. Susan was a talented fire and brimstone, like, orator, speech giver, and single mother. And what she would do is she would travel from church to church where people knew her and get up and start telling these elaborate made-up stories about finding Jesus in Mexico and having these revelatory experiences, right? While her daughter, Chris, sang gospel songs, and Chris was this amazing singer.
So basically, Hollywood grifters, the way everyone in Hollywood is still grifting.
Yeah.
Here's my story and look at the talent behind it.
Right. And then they'd inspire people to drop more cash in the church collection plate than usual. And then in turn, you know, these guys who knew her from the church, preachers or whoever, mm-hmm. would give her a cut of the profits for their trouble, right?
Good, sounds like a good hustle to me. I'm on board.
Tony Alamo was just a total weirdo. He changed his name several times and ended up in Hollywood. Some sources say that he maybe had sang on a couple songs. Like uh-huh. he might have been like a low-level recording like artist at some point. Apparently he changed his name to Tony Alamo because he thought it sounded like Frank Sinatra's friend or something like that.
I mean it does in the worst low rent way of all time. I mean he's right. Tony Alamo just sounds like not a star, but someone who's like, oh yeah, didn't they do that thing that was good that one time?
Yeah, right. And I think he's banking on that. He ended up in Hollywood pretty much flat broke with a story about how he was this big time music producer and had worked with the Beatles as a promoter, neither of which were true. So Tony and Susan met at a bar. Susan trying to scam this big shot music producer into launching her daughter's singing career, and Tony trying to scam this classy looking, husky voiced broad into buying his drink.
So, I think this sounds like the way you and I met. This sounds like very early Nick and Muriel to me. I relate to these two so far.
We met when we were 16. They were married a short time later in Las Vegas and really quickly became the self-proclaimed creators of the Jesus Freak movement. So this is in like the late 60s.
You mean that term, Jesus Freak?
Yeah. So they claim that that's them. They're very early users of the phrase, you know, so I don't know.
So maybe they did.
But they say it's more their thing.
They probably didn't, but I mean, maybe they did.
They're in the ballpark of being in the right era to have coined that. Right?
Yeah, just like how you and I coined like fire or something.
So they go to Hollywood and Vine, the piss-soaked heart of the Walk of Stars, to preach about Jesus to long-haired hippies, drug addicts, alcoholics, and then whoever, you know, pretty much whoever was down and out looking for some saving. Mm-hmm. They preaching their own sort of brand of Pentecostalism, which we've talked about this in the past, right? That's like some of it might be hold this snake and see if it bites you, right? Like it can be kind of wild. Like
it has nothing to do with like reading the Bible or understanding it. It just has to do with how you feel about God.
Yeah, there's some, a lot of it's like feeling the Holy Spirit, speaking in tongues, singing, doing that kind of stuff. I feel like I'm being offensive, but that's kind of generally speaking.
Yeah, I mean,
really
it's not,
being into end of times, you know, it's miracles.
Not, right. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that as an approach to religion, but that is the approach. It's not what I've learned or gained from studying. It's just how I feel.
Yeah, you're right about that. I was maybe poking a little more
fun. I don't
fun.
Judge that. I
well,
mean,
I know. You're
just an
you're
approach.
Nick. I know. I found my judgment leaking out in some way about the snakes, so I apologize.
venom sinking into your veins.
So they push the Book of Revelation, right, and this whole end times thing, along with miracles are real. That was their main thing, and then singing and dancing. And they'd truck young hippies down to these sandy California beaches and baptize them in the ocean.
Just with surfers and everything.
Yeah.
The weed shops along Venice.
Yeah. Around 1970, Tony and Susan Alamo were up and running with the Alamo Christian Foundation and were officially televangelists. Tony up there looking like a misshapen late stage Elvis Presley, and Susan a platinum blonde with thick makeup and a long admonishing face.
I just am imagining the alien from Mars Attacks who wears
kind
the
of
wig
actually
on the poster.
It's a little bit.
That's all I can think of when you say that. For
it's
some reason.
Very similar. They preach the gospel on television with the help of lights, sets, and a big band pumping out worship music straight from the heart of Hollywood, California.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did you say, how did they get the funding for that? That's
I was
a
just
big
about
thing.
To say it.
Oh, you're about to say it now. Okay. I was like, you can't just do that. Trust me. If you could do that, just I would have done it already.
All this was funded by donations, of course.
Okay.
A lot of which came from their followers in Los Angeles, liquidating everything they had and handing it over to the Alamos to spread the word of Jesus. Classic cult behavior.
This is why you guys need to sign up for our Patreon.
The couple initially started collecting hippies in a house in West Hollywood, and it was mostly like singing and clapping and good times. Mm-hmm. Eventually, they had about 200 people living in a 3-bedroom house on Crescent Heights and Sunset that was full of code violations and had really super gross, unsanitary living conditions. And by then, neighbors were getting suspicious. And some of that was definitely unwarranted suspicion of hippies. But people were also, you know, getting a tingling that this West Hollywood house was looking a little culty, right?
Oh, it's really fun to say. I know. We got to get on. Sorry. But this is very close to where we are right now. We're recording this far from that at all. It's
from that
house. It's not our neighborhood, but Sunset in La Cienega is not far at all.
Sunset, it's Crescent Heights and Sunset.
Oh, Crescent Heights. That's even,
it's closer,
baby.
Yeah. The Alamos decided to buy property about 45 minutes outside of Los Angeles, up north past Charles Manson country. So if you go from West Hollywood and you kind of drive north up into the mountains, then Charles Manson's ranch would kind of be
right
just outside of town, right on your left.
Nice.
Yeah.
Miro doesn't know the difference between left and right.
I put my old hand up.
She did that. Might not even be true.
It is.
It's definitely on the left.
Yeah. Okay. Jerk. I can do it if I put my L hand up, then I know. So they ended up settling in Mint Canyon in Saugus, California. This tiny remote town was inundated with the foundation's long-haired street preachers coming in by the busload. And presumably, a few of those were Claudia Kinney and her future husband, Mark Greiner. There, the Alamos ramped up their money-making operation. They obviously were tax exempt because they were a church. They put together some nonprofit organizations, like a very crazy web of different businesses, right? To avoid paying taxes. And then they put their followers to work, picking cotton, picking grapes, doing farm labor, general manual labor, and then diverting every single paycheck to the church. Their followers slept 20 to 30 people in a room with barely any access to bathing water, let alone water to like wash their clothes or their cloth diapers that the Alamos insisted the women use for the alarming amount of babies being born into the cult. And then meanwhile, of course, Susan and Tony lived in this big luxurious house right on the compound. So all of this was going down right around the time Claudia Kinney married her first husband, Mark Greiner, on this compound. We know that from her marriage announcement.
Right.
Both self-identifying as missionaries of the gospel of Jesus Christ at the foundation, with the ceremony being performed by televangelist superstars Susan and Tony Alamo in the flesh. 1 year after their marriage, Claudia gave birth to Angela Greiner around the same time as a crop of 24 children were born into the cult.
Crazy.
When Susan Alamo's daughter, Chris, was the one who was the singer, was about 20 years old, she attempted to leave the church with her two young children. She saw how children were being treated. Mm-hmm. She saw the writing on the wall and she wanted out. And her story is really emblematic of most of the stories of people who also tried to leave the church. So she went to confront her mother. She said, I'm leaving. And Susan Alamo told her, I'll kill you first. Mm. And she ended up like running to her room, trying to pack her little kid. They're very young, like 3 and a baby, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to pack her kid's stuff. And Susan Alamo came in with a group of her followers and had her daughter severely beaten as punishment, beaten into unconsciousness. So Chris woke up and called the police. And the police came, and she managed to escape the compound with her eldest child, but had to leave behind the baby. The baby they just couldn't find.
Oh my
Susan
God.
Had taken the baby.
Oh.
So the cult's lawyer contacted Chris at the local police department while she was there with her older child and, you know, called there and offered Chris a deal. If she didn't press charges, she could come back to the compound and retrieve her baby. And then her family would be exiled from the foundation.
Seems like take the deal and then press charges anyways.
That's what I thought. But I think she genuinely thought that Susan was going to have her killed. And the cult did have a history of having people followed. And so I think she felt very unsafe.
Well, and she just got beat into being unconscious.
Yeah. So Chris took the deal. She went to the compound, had one last confrontation with her mother, got her baby back, and her husband refused to go with her, which was really common also. Like the couples would split like that. Mm. So Chris left her husband behind in the cult and severed all ties for the rest of her life. She Damn. Just took her kids and ran. After Chris left, Tony and Susan Alamo put hard pressure on keeping people from leaving, threatening folks with exile from their families, right? They told their followers if they left, they would go insane, die, or turn into homosexuals. They split families up, banned adult siblings from interacting with each other, and they went hard on their spare the rod, spoil the child policy. On this,
what does that mean?
So like that if you don't beat your kids, they're going to turn out bad. So
oh, if you spare the rod, then you will spoil the child.
Yeah.
Okay.
On the Saugus property, there was a little private room in the back of the church where parents would be instructed to take their kids for punishment. And there, Tony and Susan would instruct parents to beat the devil out of their children, or Susan in particular would like administer the beatings.
What? That's why you're just going to beat kids. There's nothing.
It's like if you talk back.
Yeah. But it's just like, you just want to beat children.
No, that's it's crazy. Terrible. I mean, and it's like an old school thing. Like, I mean, yeah. I think that
it was in another documentary we saw. They did the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's horrible. It's like some sort of warped interpretation of the Bible. It's, you know, whatever.
Yeah. It's like, I thought you were Pentecostal. You're not reading the Bible. You know what I mean? Don't try to blame the Bible for beating the kid.
Pentecostal people read the Bible. Stop being so... Sometimes I'm like, that's very intelligent. Then you just go run with it. And I'm like, stop saying things. Get another one-star review if you want a fan out here. You're going to get another person like the Rolling Stones guy. That was really funny. All right. Okay. So, sorry. Over the next few years, cult numbers grew and the compound got so large, local authorities started looking into the group and caught on to the fact that probably these hundreds of workers weren't being paid, right? It looked pretty not that great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Cult deprogrammers started finding the compound. Uh-huh. They came to Saugus looking for the family members of like worried relatives who are paying them, right? Police habitually raided the compound. There was a lot of heat from the fuzz. So under pressure, Tony and Susan Alamo decided to flee California and set up shop in Susan's home state of Arkansas. And around 1976, the cult made its exodus to the Bible Belt. Tony and Susan relocated the cult to the Ozarks near the town of Dyer, Arkansas, where Susan grew up. The couple moved into a 14,000 square foot mansion decked out with like statues, red carpets, big flowing red drapes, and antiques. They had a heart-shaped outdoor swimming pool. The couple drove around town in Cadillacs wearing fur coats. Like they were going for it, right? Yeah. They built dorms and apartments for their followers to live in on the compound separately. The compound included a baby nursery, a school for the children, and a sound stage to broadcast their TV program. Also, armed guards were stationed around the perimeter. And just remember at this point, at least Rebecca Gay, the person we know of, is about a year and a half old.
Something in there. So she's definitely there. But do we know that Angela and Claudia are there?
All we know is this one mention in this blog post from 2005. Okay. And that is around 1986, 87, when the girls were a little over maybe 10 or 11 years old.
Right.
But if Angela Greiner and, you know, Claudia were there in the compound along with Rebecca Gay, mm-hmm. this is giving us the example of where they grew up and what their childhood was like.
Insight into their life.
Yeah.
Right, right.
The cult basically overtook downtown Dyer, and they had all kinds of businesses because they had free labor, right? So they had a hog farm, a really popular cafe, a bakery, this like high-end Western clothing store in Nashville, Tennessee. Cult members were working at the stores 5 to 7 days a week, 15-hour days, and then handing all their money over to the Alamos. And the Alamos discouraged birth control, so lots of kids were born. And the children were used as another type of coercive control, a way to keep people in the cult. Like, you can leave, but your kid isn't going anywhere, mm-hmm. right? Or the mom's going to stay, so she's going to keep the kids, and the dad can leave, but he can't take his kids with him. They also used the children to try and butter up their neighbors. So locals thought the foundation was pretty weird, right? The Alamos thought the Bible Belt would be more friendly to the foundation.
It's like, and, yeah, we're down with churches, not whatever the hell you're doing.
Right. Well, they thought, you know, hey, they're going to be like more into this in our brand of religion than California was, right? But even in tiny Dyer,
actual Christians down here.
But even in tiny Dyer, Arkansas, folks were like, is this a cult?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So Susan and Tony had the bright idea of using photos and testimonials from children to create a "we're totally not a cult" propaganda pamphlet. So they passed it out to people and it moderately worked, right? Uh-huh. Also, Tony Alamo somehow got Dolly Parton to do a show at the Foundation's cafe/nightclub mm-hmm. in Dyer, which was huge. Bill and Hillary Clinton went to that performance.
Damn.
And Bill Clinton described Tony Alamo as Roy Orbison on speed.
and trust me, Bill knew. They were doing speed in the bathroom.
I thought that was really funny. But life on the compound was very different for the children than people were led to believe. By 1980, frequent beatings were a part of life for the children of the foundation. They used a big wooden paddle for the spankings called the Board of Education. And the children were universally, absolutely terrified of Susan and Tony. What? Why are you laughing?
It's not funny. The Board of Education is, it's a horror. It's a great joke for something terrible.
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know.
I mean, to call it the Board of Education.
It's like, ridiculous.
It's like. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm in the middle of telling the story, yeah. So you just do you, man.
I apologize.
The Alamo Empire absolutely exploded. They were earning money hand over fist, creating all of these businesses and employing all of these people for no money. But in 1982, things drastically changed. Up until this point, Susan Alamo had faked cancer for years as a tactic to prove God exists. Like, she should be dead, but God keeps her alive. And if Susie had a flare-up of pretend cancer, it was always because the congregation wasn't being faithful enough. Well, in 1982, Susan got cancer for real and died.
Oh, wow.
Tony Alamo lost his mind and refused to bury her, and things got way, way worse for the members of the foundation. And that's where we're going to pick up in our next episode.
Damn, Muriel. Coming through with some additional information. Huge backstories. You know, good ass job. This is crazy. All right, good job. Oh, and also, by the way, part two available right now on Patreon or Spotify exclusive. You
yeah,
know what
you
I mean?
Know we're not going to leave you hanging. We love you.
Yeah, that's right. Part two will be coming out next week, or you could sign up
for
you
Patreon.
Know?
Just give us $5.
You know, give us $5. Oh my God, who are we? We're not the Alamos or Alamos or whatever their names are. We're just good, normal Hollywood people.
We're not Hollywood people. We're weirdos from Seattle. All right, see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to Muriel's Murders. Muriel did all the rabbit holing, the researching, the clicking of links, the following up on weird little tidbits of misinformation. You know what I mean? She did all the writing. She did the hosting. I did the recording, the editing, the interrupting. It's a full-on mom and pop operation. You know, we recorded
the
this.
Beer the beer drinking.
Yeah, the beer drinking. Hey man, they sell 90-minute Imperial IPAs in what is a gigantic can these days, so that's cool.
Mario Castellini did our music. You can find him at
Castellini Beats on Instagram. Hit us up on social media. We try to follow everyone back. We love staying up on you and your beautiful lives. You guys are amazing. Murosmurders.com has more information. Something else. I don't remember.
Yeah. Just, you know, have a great day.
Yeah, for sure. And either check us right now on Patreon or Spotify exclusive. And if not then we'll see you next week with part two.